Welcome. Thank you for watching this teaching video from Oak Tree Community Church in South Bend, Indiana. Please check out our other videos and don't forget to like and subscribe. Our mission is to help people come to know Jesus better and love Him more every day. We believe this will not only help our own spiritual growth, but also help us better influence the community and the world for Christ. For more information about Oak Tree, please visit us at oaktreechurch.com. There you'll find past message series, online giving options, and more information about our discipleship process that we call The Path. Now, enjoy this message. We'd love to hear from you in the comments or the website contact form. Thank you.
All right, Revelation chapter 10. Now, we took a break last week, right? We took a break last week because my friend Dwight Hostetler was here from Word of Life in South Africa and gave some pretty interesting statistics about what's going on, not just in Africa, but around the world during lunch. We were having some talk, and somebody said, you know, I think that, I don't remember who, but I think that 85% of pastors across the world are untrained. They have no training at all. They just open their Bible and read it and teach it, which sounds like it should be a good. It sounds like it should be a good thing because that's what we teach, right? We teach a literal method of interpretation. What it says is what it means. The problem is when you have no training at all, you really do have training because you have an entire background of stuff that you've heard. You have an entire background of stuff that maybe you've been taught in churches. Maybe I'm aware of this. I'm not picking on Africa, but because it's definitely not the only place in the world. But if you grow up in a pagan tribalistic system, and that's the only system you know, and you start reading the Bible, and there's promises to these people and those people and whatever, all of a sudden you bring all of that baggage with you. And so it's not just they don't know anything, they're a blank slate, and they're starting with the Bible. That would be better. What it is they have a warped slate because of all of this religious or tribalistic or whatever baggage, and then they think they're just reading the Bible, but in fact, they're bringing that into it. And so he said 85% of pastors are untrained, and somebody said, I think that's probably a pretty conservative number, and he says, yeah, I think that was a number from several years ago. I think that's probably higher now. Many more are untrained. Tina? At least Africa. Yeah, I don't know if it was Africa or worldwide. I would imagine it's got to be the same. Yeah. Worldwide? Yeah. 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 And just because, by the way, those are just statistics of, okay, this person went to seminary, you know, whatever. Just because a person goes to seminary does not mean that they are actually trained, number one, or trained well, number two. So that number, you know, maybe if I go to seminary and I get a really, really bad training, I'm trained and I don't fit within that number, even though I'm not a good teacher. Okay, so that number of when we say trained, we really should be talking about trained in a biblical perspective, a biblical worldview, right? Yeah, the vast, vast, vast majority of people who teach on a regular basis, who pastor on a regular basis, then we extend that out to seminary professors and everything who are teaching a very liberal perspective of Scripture or don't teach Scripture at all in a seminary. It's really bad. It's really bad. So he's doing a lot of work with training pastors. And I get to do a little bit of that when I'm in Africa. I've done that in Uganda and Ethiopia. I hope to be able to do that in Kenya here soon as well, possibly Zimbabwe. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to help train pastors because, I mean, you know this. I mean, just think of the math. If I'm right here and I can help other people, you know, train other people, I can't go everywhere in the world. Dwight can't go everywhere in the world, right? But if we can train people who can train people who can train people, that expands and multiplies it exponentially. And by the way, that's how discipleship works. That's how discipleship works. You work with one person, and then they work with one person while you work with one person, and it just builds out from there. So really appreciate what Dwight's doing there, what Word of Life is doing there. But that means that we took a break from the Revelation last week, and 2 weeks ago we got into chapters 8 and 9, which were the first of the major judgments that God is going to pour out on this world. Let's go over to the whiteboard just quickly and just get a sense of where we are. The cross, of course, is, well, the cross. That was the year AD 33, and then we have this tilde, this approximate with the red circle around it, is the church age. We know when the church age started, but we don't know when it's going to end. Because when it ends is when Jesus comes back in the rapture and he says, I'm taking the church to be with me. At that point, the stage is set for what Daniel heard in his vision, I think it was Gabriel the angel told him, there will be 70 weeks, 70 sets of 7 years, and we did the math, and we'll see that again today a little bit. 70 sets of 7 years, so 490 total years, that the purpose is to bring sin to an end, bring holiness into Israel. He said, it's about your people, Israel. It's about your holy city, Jerusalem. And there are several things that are supposed to happen. And 483, 69 of these sets have already taken place. We can see them in history. But one of them is left to happen. One of them has not yet happened yet. And Daniel gives us a little bit of information about that in Daniel chapters 11 and 12, but not a ton of detail. And Jesus talks about it a little bit at the end of Matthew, Mark, and Luke in those Gospels when he was teaching the disciples literally hours before the Last Supper, hours before his betrayal, before his crucifixion, the day before his crucifixion, he was talking about this is what is coming to Israel. This is what will happen. But again, just a few details. It's not until about 60 some odd years later that John, the apostle, gets this vision with all of this information that we call the Revelation. And so Daniel sort of sets it up, Jesus sort of sets it up, but John is really the one who fills us in. And after the rapture of the church, the stage is set for this last period of 7 years, and we saw that chapters 4 and 5 in the Revelation give us sort of a worship scene in heaven that tells us a little bit about what's going on. And then the bulk of the book, chapters 6 through 19, cover these 7 years. And that's what we're working through right now. And it's broadly chronological. It's sort of like the big chunks are in order, but sometimes they go back and feed back information. So you can't just read from chapter 6 to 19 and say, okay, that's exactly how it's going to happen. He goes back and he says, well, and now this too. And he sort of fills in some information and then he goes forward. Well, let me give you some more information. And then he goes forward and let me give you some more information. So there's sort of a loop going on. Sometimes he'll give us some, like in chapter 7, we saw 144,000 people who were saved and sealed near the beginning. And then the end of chapter 7 jumps all the way to the end of the 7 years and says these are people who were saved during this time and they came out of it. And so, again, we have to be very careful as we're reading this. We have to, well, take a look at the words on the page. And chapter 6 is an overview of these 7 years, tells us there's going to be massive amounts of death and destruction, and some of that will be because of war, just people killing each other. Some of it will be famine. Some of it will be wild animals and disease and all the stuff that comes along with it. But then somewhere around the midpoint or somewhere after the midpoint, the first 3.5 years, we come to chapters 8 and 9 where God really starts to unleash his wrath and his destruction on the world. Okay, the first 3.5 years, there is, well, 1 Thessalonians 5 says people will be saying peace and safety. Look, everything finally, all of those troublemakers that kept, you know, preaching the whole Jesus thing and everything, somehow they disappeared. I don't know what happened to them, but life sure is nice without them around. And the world will unify and try to come together. And yeah, there will be wars and stuff, but the goal will be to unify under this one world government that we'll see. We'll find out more details about that. John hasn't told us anything about that yet, but we'll see how that's going to work out a little bit. But then at some point after the midpoint, or just before, or right around the halfway point of this 7 years, God is going to say, okay, you've had your fun. Now it's time for you to see who's really in charge here. And chapters 8 and 9 talk about seven judgments that are initiated by an angel blowing a trumpet. And we saw that it affected the vegetation and affected the salt water and affected fresh water and affected animals and industry and commerce and transportation. And the whole world is going to be affected. And we don't know how long each of these will last, except number five, we're told will last 5 months. The fifth one will last 5 months of torture on people to the point where God will prohibit them from even killing themselves. They will not be allowed to die and escape God's punishment on them. Suicide will be prevented. All they'll be doing is hurting themselves even more if they try. And so it's not a fun time at all. Okay, but now we come to chapter 10, and chapter 10 is very short. I want to read through chapter 10 all the way. It's only 11 verses, and then come back and make some comments and see if we can get maybe a couple of verses into chapter 11 as well, because they go together. So chapter 10, John said, "Then I saw another powerful angel descending from heaven." He's seen some powerful angels. At the beginning of chapter 8, there was an angel who was given a key to the abyss, and we'll see that concept show up again in the Revelation, and some demons or something were let out of that abyss. And so that was a powerful angel. And John says, "Now I saw another powerful angel descending from heaven, wrapped in a cloud," sort of weird, "with a rainbow or a halo." Don't think just rainbow, because the same word, the same Greek word for rainbow is halo. So it might just be a halo, some kind of light, right? Encircled above his head. His face was like the sun. His legs were like pillars of fire. Now, who does that, based on everything that we've read in the Revelation so far, who does that sound like? It sounds like Jesus, right? I'm going to tell you why I think it's not. But that's what it sounds like if you go just by what's going on here. So that's great. We're already thinking, okay, maybe that's Jesus. He held in his hand a little scroll that was open. This is not the same scroll as in chapter 5. This is not the one where it was sealed seven times and every time they broke a seal. This is completely different. In fact, it's a completely different Greek word. Okay, it's a tiny scroll. It's a little book. It's a notebook. It's whatever you want to think of. It's small. Okay, it's not the big one. This is completely different. Don't confuse those scrolls. So he had in his hand a little scroll that was open, and he put his right foot on the sea, and he put his left on the land. And then he shouted in a loud voice like a lion roaring. Again, lion of the tribe of Judah. It makes us think Jesus. And when he shouted, the seven thunders sounded their voices. Okay, that should cause us, who are the seven thunders? What are the seven thunders? That is brand new. You're not allowed to introduce a character without a little bit of backstory, without a little bit of what the seven, and the seven thunders sounded to. Hold on a second. I don't know who that is. When, verse 4, when the seven thunders spoke, John said, I was preparing to write. That's good, because I want to know what they said. But just then I heard a voice from heaven say, seal up what the seven thunders spoke and do not write it down. So now we have two questions. Who or what are these things? What did they say? What did they say? Then The angel I saw standing on the sea and on the land raised his right hand to heaven and swore by the one who lives forever and ever, who created heaven and what is in it, and the earth and what is in it, and the sea and what is in it. And this is what he said, there will be no more delay. But, verse 7, in the days when the seventh angel... But in the days when the seventh angel is about to blow his trumpet, the mystery of God is completed, just as he has proclaimed to his servants, the prophets. That's what this powerful angel said. Then the voice I had heard from heaven began to speak to me again. Go, take the open scroll in the hand of the angel who is standing on the sea and on the land. So I went to the angel and asked him to give me the little scroll. He said to me, take the scroll and eat it. This just gets weirder and weirder every verse. It will make your stomach bitter, but it will be as sweet as honey in your mouth. So, what did he do? Took the little scroll from the angel's hand and ate it. And it did taste as sweet as honey in my mouth. But when I had eaten it, my stomach became bitter. Then they told me, you must prophesy again about many peoples, nations, languages, and kings. No problem, right? No problem. All right, this is great. You're going to love this. You're actually going to love this. Chapter 10 is one of the most difficult chapters in the book of the Revelation. Okay, telling you that right now, I'm admitting it. It is one of the most difficult. We just read it. It's weird. It's got characters or players in here that we've never heard of before. We don't know what they are. We don't know what they say. We don't know what they're doing. John is supposed to eat a book, right? I mean, you've heard of devouring a book, but I don't think that's that exactly what that means, right? He's literally supposed to eat this little scroll. Here's what we don't know. Who is the strong angel? Sounds like Jesus. I don't think it is, and I'll show you why. And you may have already picked up on it, actually. We don't know who the strong angel is. He's not named. We don't know what are the seven thunders. We don't know what did they say. We don't know what's in the little book or in the scroll. We have no idea because he didn't read it for us. He ate it. And that's a great way to get rid of something you don't want anybody to read, right? Ever had a little note? Somebody writes you a note and you tear it off and you're like, you know, eat it, right? That's how you get rid of something that you don't want somebody to read. Well, apparently, apparently we're not supposed to read what's in the scroll. Now, here's what's interesting. If we go back to the book of Daniel, and we've been there several times through the series, and we'll be there more, but if we go back to Daniel chapter 12. This is really interesting. I'm not going to say that this is exactly the same thing. I won't go there, but this is a really interesting connection. In Daniel chapter 12, follows, interestingly enough, chapters 10 and 11. And in chapter 11, Daniel is talking about a ruler who is going to come and hurt Israel and really do some bad stuff to Israel. Most of that prophecy in chapter 11 was fulfilled by a Roman a Roman general named Antiochus IV. He took the nickname Epiphanes. So maybe in your study Bible or something, you'll see him called Antiochus Epiphanes. And Epiphanes means the shining one. He was not arrogant at all, right? He took the name, I am the shining one. Antiochus IV came into Israel as a Roman general, came into Israel, and this is where we, if you know anything about Israeli history, between Malachi and Matthew, this is in the 400 years between the Testaments, right? He came in and he waged war. This is where we hear about the Maccabean revolt. The Maccabees, Judas Maccabeus, got some people, and they finally revolted. They tried to fight off Antiochus. And what was one of the big things that really ticked them off is that he came into Jerusalem rode into Jerusalem, but not on his horse, not on a donkey or a mule of some kind. He rode in with a pig and right up the steps into the temple and slaughtered the pig in the temple of God in Jerusalem, threw it up on the altar and burned it as a sacrifice to Zeus in Jerusalem in the temple of God. I can't even count on one hand how many things are wrong with that, right? Complete insult to the Jewish people and to the living God. And Antiochus fulfilled much of the prophecy in Daniel chapter 11 about this coming ruler, this coming prince, which makes people think that he is the fulfillment of the whole 70th week. Remember, the prince is going to come and he's going to do this stuff. And so people think, okay, all of this, the 70th week of Daniel is already past, and Antiochus fulfilled that prophecy. The problem is that the last couple of paragraphs of Daniel chapter 11 continue talking about a coming ruler, and Antiochus did not fulfill that part. There's nothing in the historical record that shows that he fulfilled this part. And so what we look at is say, okay, Antiochus fulfilled the first part, but there is still somebody coming that has to fulfill the rest. Okay, that's who we call the Antichrist. That's where we put this still into the future. Okay, and there will be a lot of similarities between Antiochus and what he did in the second century BC and what Antichrist will do when he comes to destroy Jerusalem and fulfill the rest of that prophecy, finally fulfill the prophecy. And one of the reasons that we think that that is going to happen is because, let's just go back just one or two verses here in chapter 11. We're in Daniel chapter 11. Reports will trouble him from the east and the north, and he'll set out in a tremendous rage to destroy and wipe out many. He'll pitch his royal tents between the seas toward the beautiful holy mountain. That'll be Mount Zion, where Jerusalem is. But he will come to his end with no one to help him. Now watch this. At that time. So whatever we're going to see in Daniel chapter 12 has to take place when this guy is doing his stuff. Okay? So if that means that Antiochus fulfilled this 2,200 years ago, that means Daniel chapter 12 also has to have happened at that time, because Daniel says, or he is told, at that time. Or the other option is that it's still future, and at that time, Daniel 12 will happen. And that's my position. That's what we believe and teach here at Oak Tree, and that's my position. At that time, Michael, the great prince, he's called the archangel in the book of Jude, verse 9. At that time, Michael, the great prince who watches over your people, Michael is especially tasked as the protector, the angelic protector of the nation of Israel. Okay, now we can't get into everything, but if we go back to chapter 10 of Daniel, we find that there are angels who protect or influence or oversee human governments in different nations. There is a demonic angel or a demon who influences and affects the United States of America. In chapter 10, we hear it's called the Prince of Persia, the Prince of Greece. We have these angels who are doing this. Well, God, at least for Israel, I don't know if this is true for the rest of the nations or not. I don't know if there's one good, one bad, but at least for Israel, Michael, the archangel, the highest angel that exists, as far as we know right now, he is especially tasked with protecting Israel. Okay, he watches over Daniel's people, and at that time, he will stand up. That's pretty cool. He will arise. And what that means, I think, is that he will step out of the way. Now, he's not the restrainer, you know, for the whole world or anything, but there's a time coming where Michael is going to step out of the way, and there will be a huge attack on Israel. More so than has ever happened. Look at verse, continue. There will be a time of distress unlike any other from the nation's beginning up to that time. Okay. So you say, well, and what about Antiochus? I mean, that was huge. That had never happened before. That's true. But throughout the last 2,000 years, there have been worse and worse and worse attacks on Israel than even Antiochus did 2,200 years ago. And I know we always think about it, we always talk about it, but the Holocaust was the worst thing that happened to Israel, okay, in the 1940s. And then shortly after that, when they gained their independence, the UN recognized Israel as a sovereign nation in 1948, there has been just one war after another. Okay, so Antiochus did not do the worst that has ever been seen in Israel. And Daniel is told there's a time coming that it will be unprecedented when it comes to destruction in Israel. But at that time, your own people and all those whose names are found written in the book will escape. Many of those who sleep in the dusty ground will awake, some to everlasting life and others to shame and everlasting abhorrence. So there's going to be a resurrection, some to go into the kingdom and some to go into the lake of fire. And but the wise will shine like the brightness of the heavenly expanse, and those bringing many to righteousness will be like the stars forever and ever. Now notice verse 4. But you, Daniel, close up these words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many will dash about and knowledge will increase. Daniel, there are certain things that Daniel saw and heard that apparently he was writing down or was told to write down and then seal it up, and nobody was supposed to look at it or get it. It included the stuff that we do have in Daniel, I assume, you know, because he told us about it, but I think it included more stuff as well. If we jump down to verse 5, this sets it up. I, Daniel, watched as two others stood there, one on each side of the river. This is in his vision. One said to the man clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river. This is an important question. When will the end of these wondrous events occur? That's good. That would be a good question, right? Then I heard the man clothed in linen, who was over the waters of the river, as he raised both his right and left hands to the sky and made an oath by the one who lives forever. Sound familiar? Didn't we just read this in Daniel chapter 10? Something very similar. It is for a time, times, and half a time. We've seen that before. Okay, we'll come back to that in just a second. Well, a couple minutes, I guess. Then, when the power of the one who shatters the holy people, that'll be Antichrist, has been exhausted, all these things will be finished. That's when this destruction, this unprecedented trouble will come to an end. Daniel says the same thing that you and I, when we're reading the Revelation and many other things, I heard, but I didn't understand. You're like, go, Daniel. Yeah, we're in good company, right? I heard, but I didn't understand. So I said, sir, so what will happen after these things? And he said, go, Daniel, for these matters are closed and sealed until the time of the end. Sorry, you don't get to know. Unless, and here's speculation, and I admit it's speculation, but it's a really cool speculation. Is it possible? I think it is. This is my opinion, but you don't have to accept it. Is it possible that the scroll in Daniel 12, where he's just been seeing and hearing about what Antichrist is going to do, he's seeing and hearing about the destruction that's going to come, he's seeing and hearing about the end of Antichrist, and he's told, you have to seal it up. You can't let anybody know about this until the time of the end. Is it possible that that is the scroll that is given to John and he eats it and then he has to prophesy? Because the reason I think that is because of the similarities, the one who's standing there on the sea and the land, who's having the oath, the whole thing in Daniel chapter 12 with Revelation chapter 10, the very next three chapters of the Revelation chapters 11, 12, and 13 seem to pick up where Daniel left off. Talking about Antichrist and what he's going to do in this unprecedented trouble that's going to come against Israel. It's as if Daniel 11 stops and Revelation 11 picks up, and the scroll is the thing in the middle that nobody was allowed to know until John prophesied. Now, I understand that that is speculation. I understand that that's just opinion, but I think it's really cool to think of it that way. Okay, and I see how it fits together if that is indeed true. So, let's go back to chapter 10. If we don't know all of this stuff, is there anything that we do know? Maybe. What we do know is that the strong angel is probably not Jesus. See how I like, we do know this, and it's still probably. Probably not Jesus, okay? The cloud around him does seem to support his heavenly origin. I mean, it says came down from heaven, so that's fine. It says another powerful angel. The word another typically, and we don't want to go too far into this, but typically means another of the same kind. So it's not like, it's like the angel in chapter 8 and the angel in chapter 10 are probably similar of kind. Okay, so it's not like we have an angel and we have Jesus. Okay, Jesus is not typically, especially here in the Revelation about Jesus, going to be described as just another angel. Okay, so we want to be careful with that. It sounds like there's a lot of similarity, but I think we want to be careful with that. The rainbow or the halo may have something to do with God's faithfulness, some commentators say. It's not something that we just see in the text, so that's just a possibility. The shining is a reflection of God's glory. We do have his glory as he comes out of heaven and he's about to give this judgment. His feet, the pillars of fire, sort of like Jesus, but Jesus in chapter 1 didn't say that his legs and feet were pillars of fire. It said that they were like bronze that had been purified through fire. It's somebody who's gone through fire, through, but not actually doing the judgment like the fire would be. His feet on the sea and the land. Now, this is interesting, and we'll see this again in just a couple of chapters, in chapter 13, 12 and 13. From a Jewish perspective, and this is John's perspective, he's writing about his people, you know, Daniel's people, John's people. He's writing from the perspective of Israel looking out in the rest of the world. And from a Jewish perspective, it is common, and I don't want to say that this is necessarily every time, but it seems to make sense. It's common to think of the land as the land of Israel and the sea as the Gentile nations. Okay, so when it says that the angel was standing both on the sea and on the land, that indicates that it's global. This is not just one area. This is a judgment that is going to be global. It'll affect not just the whole globe, land and water, but it'll affect all people, both Jews and Gentiles. What is coming will be global in scope, both terrestrial on the planet and population-wise. Jews will not be exempt. Gentiles will not be exempt. This is about everybody. Okay? So those are some of the things that we do know. What else do we know? It's interesting, and it's just sort of an interesting thing. This is not the last time that John does anything in a vision, but this is the last time he interacts with a person. He's not, unless I missed something when I was reading through, I don't see him ever interacting with another angel or something again. From here on out, he may be doing something, but for the most part, he's watching what is coming, okay? Almost like a dream. I had somebody asked me just yesterday, 2 days ago, I think maybe, what's the difference between dreams and visions? And this question, for whatever reason, has come up recently over the course of the last year, or several times over the course of the last year. And from what I can tell, a dream, you're pretty passive in a dream. You're just sort of watching it. Whereas in a vision, I mean, think of Ezekiel's vision and John's vision and Daniel's vision, all these visions, they're actually engaged. They're talking to people. They're getting answers back. They're doing things. The difference between a dream and a vision. Well, John's vision is not going to end. And he will still do some things, but he will become more passive as things get worse. He's going to take sort of a back seat. He won't be as active as he has been in some ways. Okay. Verses 5 through 7 tell us that the judgments are coming to an end. What he swore, this angel, what he swore by the Creator, which by the way is Jesus, so I'm not sure Jesus swearing by the one who lives forever and ever and the Creator, I don't think Jesus would swear by God the Father. It's possible, but I don't think so. I think this is an angel. At the end of verse 6 and into verse 7, there will be no more delay. There will be no more delay, but in the days when the seventh angel is about to blow his trumpet, the mystery, the stuff that was not yet revealed but is now being revealed, will be brought to an end. And so what I think we can do is we can place chapter 10 on our timeline now toward the end of at least the midpoint of the second half, the last quarter, or somewhere toward the end, because it's the seventh trumpet and the judgments that are going to come out of that, and then the end is coming. So what John sees seems like, I'm just going to go ahead and put chapter 10 somewhere in this neighborhood. I'm not saying that there's an exact day or point or something specific. I'm just going to put chapter 10 right here because we know it's going to be close to the end of the 70th week as things are starting to wrap up and be completed. The little scroll, here's something we know, the little scroll contained more prophecy of global judgment. Verse 11, he's after he ate it, you must prophesy again about many peoples, nations, languages, and kings. And I think that's a great connection, like I said, back to Daniel. I really do. I think that ties it together. But again, that's my opinion. You don't have to do anything about that. But it would be bittersweet. Right? It would be bittersweet. It would be sweet in his mouth when he ate it. Yay, I have a new prophecy. But it makes him sick to his stomach when he finds out what that prophecy has to be. See that? Sweet in his mouth, but then it goes down into his stomach and it makes him sick to his stomach. Here's something that's really cool. In Ezekiel chapter 2 and into 3. Where's Ezekiel? Ezekiel. Occasionally, we do a thing around here called Eat This Book. And what Eat This Book is it's a teaching series, and we have lunch afterward on Sundays when we have second hour now. And for each week during the Eat This Book series, we intentionally are eating a meal while we're discussing even further. There are certain things that I don't teach in the message that I specifically save until lunch and learn, and we have a lot of questions, sort of like what second hour is doing now, but a little bit more intentional. And the concept of Eat This Book comes out of Ezekiel, okay? And we're seeing a parallel here. Look at Ezekiel chapter 2. Just let's look down at verse 8. This is Ezekiel when he was being commissioned to do his ministry. God says, "As for you, son of man, listen to what I'm saying to you. Do not rebel like that rebellious house. Open your mouth and eat what I'm giving you." Okay. I'm just telling you, if you've never done this before, if somebody says, "Close your eyes and open your mouth," don't do it. Especially if that person is only about this big, right? Close your eyes and open. No, I don't think I will. I think maybe you're going to show me what you're going to feed me first. But here, he didn't say close your eyes, but that's the picture I have in my head. Open your mouth and eat what I'm giving you. Maybe you should tell me what you're giving me first. No, you got to trust me. Then I looked and I realized a hand was stretched out to me and in it was a written scroll. He unrolled it before me, and it had writing on the front and the back, and written on it were laments, mourning, and woe. Well, that's all sorts of exciting, right? That just tastes great. He said to me in chapter 3, "Son of man, eat what you see in front of you. Eat the scroll. Eat this book." That's where our series comes from. and then go and speak to the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth and he fed me the scroll. And he said to me, Son of man, feed your stomach and fill your belly with the scroll I'm giving it to you. So I ate it and it was sweet like honey in my mouth. You see these correlations. If all you do is you jump to the end of the book and you read the Revelation, but you don't have a basis in the Old Testament, you're not seeing these things. When John was told, eat the scroll, his mind, I imagine, immediately went back to at least Ezekiel, if not also Daniel. Okay, I am doing what these prophets before me had to do. I am fulfilling what they couldn't finish or whatever I am finishing is going through John's mind as far as I can tell. He said to me, Son of man, go to the house of Israel and speak my words, for you're not being sent to a people of unintelligible speech and difficult language. You don't even have to learn a new language. Go to your own people. Not too many peoples of unintelligible speech and difficult language whose words you cannot understand. Surely, if I had sent you to them, this is interesting, if I had sent you to someone whose language you don't understand, at least they would have listened to you. But the house of Israel is unwilling to listen to you because they are not willing to listen to me. Isn't that interesting? The reason they won't listen to you, prophet, is because they won't listen to me, who I'm giving you the words to say. This is exactly what Jesus said throughout the Gospels. If you accept me, you're not really accepting me, you're accepting the one who sent me. I don't speak on my own agenda, I don't work on my own agenda. If you don't trust me, if you don't accept me, you're rejecting the one who sent me. I speak what I've been given. And you don't listen, and it's not just me you're rejecting, you're rejecting God altogether. The house of Israel is unwilling to listen to you because they are not willing to listen to me, because the whole, or for the whole house of Israel is hard-headed and hard-hearted. Hard-headed and hard-hearted. So we see a connection. Here we are, Revelation chapter 10, probably the most difficult chapter in the entire book. There's all this stuff you're reading through, you're like, I don't know that. But we can go back to the book of Daniel and see a connection. We can go back to the book of Ezekiel and see a connection. And those aren't the only ones. Those are just the ones that I'm pointing out today. Chapter 11, then, for these first couple of verses, actually makes a connection between chapter 10. Look at Revelation chapter 11, just these first couple of verses, okay? There's so much that we don't know in chapter 10, but there's a connection. Then a measuring rod like a staff was given to me, John says, and I was told to get up and measure the temple of God and the altar and the ones who worship there. That's Jewish people. But don't measure the outer courtyard of the temple. That's the Gentile area. Leave it out because it has been given to the Gentiles and they will trample on the holy city for 42 months. Now, chapter 11 is going to have three sections to it. I think this is beginning the prophecy from the little scroll that he sees in chapter 10. We're just going to look at these first two verses, and next week we'll come to the two witnesses and the seventh trumpet, and we'll just keep moving on. But basically, this is what we see. There will be a functioning temple built again. There's not a temple in Jerusalem right now, but there will be. We don't know. There's so much. There's no way to know. How is it right now? There's a Muslim mosque right where the temple should be. And you can be sure that they are not going to tear that down or move it so that a Jewish temple can be built. Not going to happen unless something miraculous takes place. And what we don't know is what exactly is going on. The Antichrist may have something to do with it. The coalition of nations may have something to do with it. God may just knock it down because he can and that the Jews swoop in and build. All I know is that right now, today, there is a group in Jerusalem called the Temple Institute that they have everything ready to rebuild the temple. They have it sort of like in Lego format, block format, modular, where they can build it very quickly. Very, very quickly. They'll be able to put this up in a matter of probably weeks, if not days. They have everything ready to go. They've got all the utensils. They've got the altar built. They've got everything ready to go except for one thing. That is the red heifer. According to the Mosaic law, there has to be a red heifer cow that is slaughtered and burnt, and the ashes are what God says will purify all of the stuff. And so every so often, and I've mentioned it here before, every so often, they think they have found a perfect red heifer somewhere in the world. Doesn't matter where it comes from. It has to be 1 year old, and it has to be completely red, literally from nose to tail. Can't have even one tiny non-red spot or hair or anything anywhere. And whenever they think they found one, it has to be perfect. It can't have any broken, you know, legs or anything. It has to be perfect. It is sectioned off from the rest of the herd, and it is protected for a year. And as it comes up on its first birthday, rabbis are hired to come in and literally magnifying glass inspect every hair on this heifer, one at a time, picking through every hair. And inevitably, what has happened so far is one that starts completely red. By the time we get to the first year, there's always something that changes. Right? The nose isn't the right shade. There's a little bit of hair that is maybe lightened up or darkened up, or maybe it's white or, you know, whatever. Something on the hoof isn't red. There's always something that has made it so that that animal cannot be used for the sacrifice to purify the temple. But that's what they're waiting. That's all they're waiting for. They would do it today if they could. And the thing is that there is nothing that says that the temple can't be built today. If they had the place to do it. There's nothing on the timeline that says that the temple can't be built. All we know is that it has to be built. There's nothing that says that a temple can't be built and torn down 14 times between now and when this timeline starts. People talk about the third temple is going to be the thing. There's nothing that says that. All the Jewish people and the Jewish rabbis believe and teach is that Messiah will build the next temple. Messiah will build and purify the next temple. So what happens if a world leader comes by, a substitute Messiah, an anti-Christ, helps them build a temple so that they can start doing their sacrifices? What if he comes by and says, you know what, that mosque is going away because this is where the temple goes? Don't you think the entire Jewish population of the planet will surround this guy, Jew or Gentile, doesn't matter, and give him their full support if he can be the one who gives them the temple back? See, isn't it interesting how you can see this stuff play? We don't know exactly how it's going to work, but you can see it play out. God is going to allow the temple to be desecrated and trampled by Gentiles for 42 months, it says here, and we're going to get into some days and stuff next week. But eventually, what's going to happen is in this temple, Antichrist will stand there at the temple. He will erect some kind of abomination. We're not sure exactly what that is yet. I'll give you some ideas in the next few weeks. Some kind of abomination. And according to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4, he will take his seat in the temple, sit on a throne, and declare himself to be God, and demand that people worship him. That's what's coming. That's what's coming. That's what we're going to see in chapters 11 through 13. And I think that is what John found written on the little scroll that he has to now tell us about. That's what's coming. So, what do we do with that? What in the world do we do with that? Here's what we do with that. There's always a blessing for obedience if we can find something to obey in here. And you may think this is a little bit of a stretch. That's fine. But here's where I came up with. If you've got your own application, run with it. Okay? Eating is often used to illustrate receiving God's truth. We see this multiple places. Okay? And I don't want to make this too spiritualized or whatever. I don't want to stretch this too much. But it's worth the question. John was given the Word of God, and he was told to eat it. Ezekiel was given the Word of God. He was told to eat it, receive it, digest it, and then do something with it. We have the Word of God, right? Now, I'm not telling you to eat it, right? I'm telling you to eat it up, though. Right? I'm telling you to read it. I'm telling you to study it. I'm telling you to learn it, love it, devour it in a metaphorical sense, and then do something with it. Right? And it's not exactly what John had to do. Obviously, he was in a vision, but I think there is an application. Is God's word precious enough to us that we would be willing to devour it if God told us to? Literally? Why can't we do it metaphorically? Why can't we devour? Why can't we eat it up? Why don't we spend time in the scriptures studying, learning it so that we can live it out? And then we use it to impact and influence other people. We have the freedoms in this country right now to be able to share the scriptures with people at pretty much any opportunity we want. And many places in the world do not have that freedom, and we're never guaranteed to have that freedom forever. So use the freedoms that we have as we celebrate this Independence Day weekend. Use the freedoms that we have to do the ministry and the work that we're tasked to do. And then we will be able to just let God work out the things that only God can work out. We do our part, God does his part, and he's the one who receives the glory for it.